Hope everybody is good. This is our conversation from a couple of days ago with MEP Luke Ming Flanagan. Luke was in Strasbourg at the time. We obviously got into it, including the controversial vote on the Ukraine and the condemnation of Russia. If you want to hear these podcasts as they come out, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The reason we ask you for this is because we've no ads, no sponsors. It's just this annoying thing of me having to ask you to help us because we want to remain independent. So if you could, I would really appreciate it if you just click the link on the bottom of the podcast and see if there's a level that you're happy to support us at. If you are a patron, you don't need to hear this because these aren't included in them as they come out. So please get yourself the exclusive Patreon feed, the Tortoiseshack feed, which means you get all the podcasts as they're done in one place rather than across the network. Thanks for the support. Enjoy the conversation. And hope to see some of you tomorrow for our live show, live online. Looking forward to it. It's good to be back doing the Sunday shows. Thanks again. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and I'll let you listen to the podcast now. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and I'm sorry, folks, but he's done 2 days in a row. We got him. It's like, Martin, you managed to get back out of bed again.
You see, you have this reputation of me never, always being in bed. And I'm not. I'm like such an insomniac. It's unreal.
Well, you took a month off. So,
Well, that's sickness. That's sick. But I am such an insomniac. I could be awake at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Can you tell any, like, you sound better, but you tell you, lads, you're just lucky, as I keep saying, that this is audio only. Because do you remember that little thing in the little game where the skeleton would drop down onto you? That's what he looks like now.
I've lost a fair amount of weight, actually.
Off your ears.
no belly anymore.
Anyway, the world's smallest man is shrinking. listen, we better focus on events. We are rejoined on the podcast by MEP, Irish MEP, and our man in the European Parliament at the moment, Luke Ming Flanagan. Luke, how are you keeping?
Very good, Tony and Martin. And look, I'm good personally, but it's another grim week for the world, whether we focus on Ukraine or whether we focus on what's happening in Afghanistan or you focus on Yemen. It's hell on earth for the people who are there. And all I know is it's hard enough looking at it and feeling kind of helpless about it. But personally, I'm feeling good, but I wish the world was feeling a little bit better at the moment.
I think that's a fair place to start because we've seen that conversation, but you're in the European Parliament and you've seen all the levers of power, how when they can be pulled, things can happen. And you mentioned Yemen and you mentioned Afghanistan, and there are millions of people in food insecurity who are literally don't know where their next meal is coming from. The globe has, the people are, you know, the US itself is withholding aid to the people of Afghanistan to somehow punish them for 9/11, which they weren't a party to. All of these insane things that are playing out. Yet, if we were to be honest, Luke, the reaction, how have you found the reaction to the insanity of invading, of Russia's invasion of Ukraine? How have you found the idea that maybe there is something about European solidarity?
Well, the one thing that I think drives this, look, and I think it's our interest in it is driven from many angles. I believe there is a racist aspect to it. I think there is an aspect to the color of people's skin and how they are reacting to it, which is very, very sad. But I actually think the overwhelming reason why people are more interested and more tuned in on this one is the fact that I think they personally believe they could potentially be blown off this planet because of what's happening. Whereas I don't think they saw the danger as that immediate in Yemen or in Afghanistan. While at the same time, obviously, someone suffering in any country, no matter what the color of their skin or their creed, it's still all the same. It's still hell for those people. But I would, there's a part of me, because they are similar color skin to us. In the majority, more people seem to be interested, and that's wrong. But I think it's the threat of nuclear war that's really, really focusing people. But What I would say is, look, you've got to try and see what good can come out of a really dark place. And what good I think could potentially come out of this is that the word refugee anymore isn't a dirty word for a lot of people that it was. And that once they get this idea of a refugee and how important it is to help them, that, look, and I'm a glass half full person, hopefully they will extend that to others, and hopefully they will. And that not only will we look at what's happening in Ukraine and let many people in there to help them when they need help, but we also let people in from other conflicts, because it's the right thing to do, and it's something that we should be doing, because we faced it ourselves. I know it's said ad nauseum, but we did. Millions had to leave this country during the famine. We had people who had to come here across the border during the Troubles, as they were called. So, like, it's not as if we need to dig deep down in our psyche to understand, well, why would you want to help someone? It should be obvious.
And it's also showing up that the idea of direct provision is not needed at all, Luke, at all.
Yeah, it certainly isn't. And that's where, to me, the kind of the racist aspect comes into it. I don't think for a minute people are going to suggest that Ukrainian people should be put into direct provision. In fact, as far as I understand, and I'd agree with this, we're going to give them PPS numbers and we're going to let them participate in society. And one of the biggest drivers against refugees, and it's wrong, but whether it's wrong or not, you've got to realize it, is that many people feel that, well, refugees aren't contributing, and they are, and that's the reason for disliking them. I think a big cohort of those people are just using it as an excuse. They just don't like people are different. But there is a significant segment of those people that in the morning, then if those people, rather than being forced to be on social welfare, if they are serving you in a shop, if they're working in your local factory, or if they're working in your hospital as a doctor or a nurse, then you don't have that divide. So there's so many positives can come from this. And if we do it right, it'll teach us a lesson in what can be done in the future.
I made that point last night, Martin, when we were talking, and I made the point again. I saw it today when I think I said it on Twitter. I said we could simply, you know, the amount of things we could do. We've realized assets can be seized. Illicit funds can be seized. We've realized that, you know, and we can stop. We don't have to just say oligarchy stopped in the Kremlin, by the way. You know, oligarchy can encompass all sorts of illicit assets and illicit flows. And we can talk, and I will get into it because I know that was a significant vote on that where government MEPs did not contribute. But I want to come back to the controversial vote. And I say controversial because it was obviously, people will say, depending on what side of it you sit, that this was, you know, a sign of EU solidarity for Ukraine. And I think you used the phrase, Luke, that you regrettably couldn't vote with it because, you've read it, you've offered full solidarity to the people of Ukraine, but wouldn't go so far as to vote on the piece of, it was only really, a lot of it was, how do I put this? Tokenistic, but there was a lot in it. Do you want to just explain to listeners, first of all, why?
Well, to me, and maybe people might be able to relate to this more. When I was in the Dáil, there was a vote on raising the pension age and raising the minimum age or the minimum wage, all wrapped up into the same thing. So you had a situation where if you didn't vote for it, the headline would be you didn't support an increase in the minimum wage. Whereas there was no mention of the fact that actually I couldn't also support the idea that they'd raise the pension age. And in this, as there is with all resolutions, there's a variety of things thrown in. And there were things in the one in December, as there was in the one last week, which I couldn't support. But at the end of the day, the purpose of the resolution, according to listening to the media, and the general populace is that it's to send a message. And whatever about the detail in that message, the overall message was that we condemn Vladimir Putin and what he's doing in Ukraine. And in the second vote, I voted for the resolution. While I mightn't agree with some of the stuff in it, I voted for it on the basis of that what I'm voting for here isn't necessarily about the minute details of what's in the resolution. You could argue it should be, but in the space that we're in now, to me, this was a vote, do you condemn Vladimir Putin or do you not? And taking that, I voted for it because of that. There are things in it I don't like. There were things in it that should be in it that weren't in it that I'm disappointed about. But overall, given the fog that you were trying to communicate through and the level of emotion, and it's inevitable, you're seeing children being shot that are my children's age. It's inevitable there's going to be a fog of emotion. And through that fog of emotion, for me, I felt the best thing to do was to shine a ridiculously bright light through the fog. And that bright light was just to point out that I too condemn Vladimir Putin. Now, in the resolution, there are a variety of things that we can do. We can try and punish him with sanctions. We can do things like provide more weaponry, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I can't really see the positives to it. But there was one thing concrete that we could have done. And in particular, there was one concrete thing that Ireland could do, because as far as I'm concerned, even if in the morning, if we decided we were going to put all our money into weapons, which to me wouldn't make sense, we still wouldn't be in a place to defend ourselves. So to me, that's something we can't do. Why waste energy on it? And on a variety of other areas, we really can't have that much effect. But where we could have had an effect was when it comes to oligarchs' money. And in this case, you're right about all oligarchs. In a way, you shouldn't differentiate. But at the moment, the focus was on Russian oligarchs. And I'll read you the amendment that we looked to get included in that resolution. And it wasn't passed. The amendment says, recalls in the light of the Paradise Papers that most of the Russian oligarchs' assets are hidden in European tax havens, deplores this lack of tax transparency, which prevents the EU from targeting sanctions on oligarchs' assets and thus putting real pressure on them and on Putin in turn, calls for the EU to intensify its actions against European tax havens. Now, I am dubious as to how effective resolutions are, but in the current space that we're in, and having been told how important they are and how disastrous it was that I didn't vote for it in December, I'm taking the attitude that, yes, they are important and they do send a message. And in that vote that only failed by 20 MEP votes, we had a chance to send a message, a very strong message, and in particular to tax havens like Ireland, that we've got to stop what's going on and we've got to reverse out of it.
I'll let you finish, but I want to contextualize something for listeners. You mentioned dealing in arms. So in terms of illicit flows, it's well known, you know, it's into the hundreds of billions of money that has passed through either Ireland's shadow banking sector or through our Section 110 set arrangements.
I've heard a figure of 186 billion.
This is what's reported. But within that, there was so much, like, no one wants to unpick that, but we have to be honest. Imagine saying that we want to actually continue to maintain the money of the let's just say the big evil oligarchs, if that's how they're put, and yet spend money to fight them. Let's get arms to fight them. Let's buy arms to fight them, but protect their money or shelter their money. And then the second thing I want to say that's interesting is about attaching things to bills. I don't want it to slip by without it being mentioned that Pippa Hackett has slipped in on the animal health and welfare bill, that she slipped in some of the changes on forestry that we fought against only 2 years ago, on this podcast. You know,
on my way here, I seen that and I thought to myself, here it is again. This is the most cynical thing you can do in a democracy and in politics. And we are now seeing how important politics and democracy it is and how we should be honest with it. And to do something like this at the moment basically sends a message out to some people that democracy is nothing about showing contempt for people. And that's what they're doing here. And something as wonderful as democracy and the opportunity and the decision-making options it gives to ordinary people, democracy, to do something like this It's just wrong. And especially when you know that it's wrong and you know that it's designed to confuse. And to me, it's just more of it. It's just more of it. And I, look, for me, I find very, what I found very frustrating about the whole resolution is focus on certain areas and not focus on other areas. And this idea of saying, well, look at who voted against the resolution and look at the monsters and the Nazis who also voted against it. And if you can contextualize things in that way and you can put things in that way, well, then what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Because if you want to approach it from that point of view, equally, you should be saying this amendment failed by 20 votes. 10 MEPs from Alternative for Deutschland, friends of Putin, Google them. You'll hear nothing else, but they are friends of Putin. So with the help of the friends of Putin, Alternative for Deutschland, the extreme right-wing party in Germany, Hitler's descendants, basically, politically, they successfully prevented this amendment from being put in the resolution. There was only a handful of MEPs from the EPP group that voted against it. So if we're talking about who's serious about doing something about the current problem we have with Putin, and then at the same time, the most effective thing I believe that we could do is ignored by the political establishment, you start having to ask questions. How serious are they about dealing with this issue in the first place?
I kind of agree with you there on that. Look, how serious are they? I mean, it seems the opportunity seems to be used to push for and the idea of us in NATO. I mean, you're years and years away. Even if you want to do it, you're years and years away. But it seems to be that's what's happening in Ukraine is now just used as an excuse in Ireland by an overwhelming majority in mainstream press, which is completely diametrically opposed to public opinion, to push for militarization of Ireland. And the only reason they're doing it, and none of them are honest about it, is money. The amount of money and the slush funds and the whining and dining and the kickbacks from the arms industry, that's why they want it, not to defend us.
Well, you know, this thinking that was out there and which was used to basically attack me and others for the way we voted in December. And the argument was, could you not have seen this coming? Surely you knew he was going to do this. And to say you didn't, and that's the reason why you voted against it, isn't credible. Well, let's drill down into that. Because how long ago? It's 8 years ago since Vladimir Putin invaded Crimea. And we're told by the political establishment that that was bad and he shouldn't have done it. And I agree, he shouldn't have done it. So what did we do at that time? Because it's the same as him doing what he's doing now in the rest of Ukraine, unless somehow the establishment are trying to tell me that Crimea is different. Because since he invaded Crimea, part of the Ukraine, since he did this, the political establishment in Ireland continued to accept tens of billions of euro into the IFSC. So whatever about the 186 billion that's there now, and whatever about when it started, we do know since Vladimir Putin invaded Crimea, we have for the last 10 years continued to take in the money. So what are we being told here? Are we being told that somehow it was all right that he invaded Crimea and that now it's only a problem? And if that is the case, then who did not take it serious? Who was serious about doing something about this? Because if they're saying they took it serious all along, why didn't they act then rather than now?
Well, Luke, we know, like, I mean, we know the answer to this because it's simple. It's simple arithmetic. There is a huge amount of money funneled through Ireland that is used. I mean, they call them the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers. And I found the entire thing quite funny because there were, there's a house not 2 kilometers from me in Drumcondra that has over 260 of these shell companies in Drumcondra, next to where, near St. Luke's, where Bertie used to hang around. Then you can just go down and spin along the quays, and I can point out one building that houses over 600 of these. I know another building that houses over 1,200. More, and then to broaden it out, what we're seeing now is huge global default in the aviation sector because the leasing has all gone to shit. The Russians are refusing to give back the planes that they've leased out, and all of that's going to hit Dublin because Dublin is the second, well, between Dublin and Singapore. That's
Dublin is a laundromat for every crook in the world.
Martin lives in Ashbourne, but outside of him, yes. But in fairness, like the real trouble we have here is that we've hooked ourselves up to this as that's what we do now. I often make the point that Ireland is like the best waven pipes in the world. You can filter your money through it, and we'll just charge you a service charge for using our pipes. We don't really tax it. We call it a tax, but it's a service charge.
We're a conduit. That's what we are.
But can I ask you though, when you talk to other Irish MEPs and members of your own group and members of the EPP, the likes of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, surely now they need to get serious about addressing our role in the global tax avoidance chain.
No, they're not. Probably in the same way as Newcastle United fan doesn't want to face the reality of where their future success and their great lifestyle is going to come from. And I think that's what drives it. And moral considerations and who ends up quite literally dead in a ditch, that doesn't come into it, so it seems. Mm. And if it did, they'd have voted for this amendment. And I'll say it again, I don't think that amendment was going to change at all. But in the context of, if you don't vote for a resolution, you're going to cause a war, well then fine. If resolutions are that strong, put these things into it and show us how serious you are. We'll be coming back again, given how successful this amendment was and how close it was to passing. When there's another opportunity, we will be pushing this again. But I repeat it and call it tabloid thinking. But that's what I'm dealing with now. So I'm going to fight fire with fire. This amendment failed to pass because the far right extremists from Germany didn't want it to pass. Like, that's just the reality. So it's one hell of a coalition of the extreme right and, well, what they call the center right in the European Parliament. And I think there should be more focus on it. And while people criticize social media, without Twitter, this would never, ever have been heard about. The initial tweet that I put out is currently on 480,000 views. And all of the satellite, as I would call them, quote-tweeted versions of it, mean it all adds up to about 700,000. As far as I know, it has not appeared in any of the newspapers. And you'd have to wonder why, because surely it's interesting to the Irish public. Surely it's something they should be concerned about and they should know about. But, people wonder why people look for alternative news sources. The reason why they look for alternative news sources is because things like this don't come out in our newspapers that sell in every shop.
The Comex scandal was brought out by Jack Power in conjunction with other newspapers around Germany, but he did it in the Irish Times. But I will say it really wasn't as big a story as it actually was. It was fucking criminal what was going on, and again, Irish companies that advertise in these outlets. It's one of the reasons I always say, imagine me giving out about banks now, and then you had to listen in a few seconds to, oh, here's an ad from AIB, or Martin's going to read you a thing. Can't have it. Can't do it. Go on.
I was just going to say, and just to broaden it out a little, Luke, we have to start asking questions. Should we be doing business at all with countries who have a very poor human rights track record, which includes Russia? And I'm particularly thinking of China. And I'm particularly thinking, why do we do business with China when we know that their human rights record is absolutely diabolical? And I don't mean us as in Ireland. I mean us as in the supposedly free democratic West world. Why are we doing business with these people at all? All it's doing, all we've done with Putin was embolden him to do what he has done. That's all we've done.
Well, the question has to be asked, which would be more effective? Voting for a resolution or not heading over to Russia and making a public statement as an Irish politician that we've got to get rid of the sanctions, basically, because we want to sell them more beef. Which would be more effective? We all know which would be more effective, but the resolution. Which would be more important? Rooting that money out of this country. Oh, but the resolution, you didn't vote for it. And every time you mention what actually could be done, but the revolution. Or the resolution. Excuse my
Freudian
slip.
No problem. No problem, comrade.
There's no focus on what we can do for some reason and would be effective. And all the focus is on what's impossible and what wrecks people's heads to make a decision about. You know,
Luke, I'm going to move on. The last time we spoke, you were doing a lot of work on the common agricultural policy. We were talking about things that were happening there, how you were trying to benefit actual, not big agriculture, but the actual small farmer. But you also were talking recently about the erection of the Agri Committee and the ecological focus. Do you want to just fill in our listeners a little bit about that? It's another interesting insight to how things don't go reported, first of all, and how things get done around the table, and what vested interests, how they react to things.
Yeah, well, look, I'll be honest with you, and it's out there, and people are saying this, and I think it's right. People have gone from becoming experts on an epidemic to now becoming an expert on geopolitics. And I have to say, I am far from an expert on either of those topics. So in a way, I'm kind of glad you're moving on. And for the last 8 years ago, I didn't know much about the whole agriculture area. Or rural development that could be said as well. But for the last 8 years, I have pretty much exclusively as an MEP concentrated on the Agriculture Committee. And during that period of time, we have put together the new Common Agricultural Policy. There's a farm to fork strategy, a biodiversity strategy, and a Green Deal. And all of these things are evolving at the moment. And now at the moment, what our focus is, it's fairly obvious what our focus is. How will agriculture deal with the war in Ukraine? And the reason why there's such a focus on that is because obviously with globalization, there is such connections all around the world in our food systems that one is dependent on the other. And we now have a situation where 30% of our wheat, which came from Ukraine, we have a big problem in obviously sourcing that. 85% of our sunflower oil, lots of our soy and lots of our animal feed. There is going to be a problem with getting that now. So we have to make some decisions on that. What are we going to do? And there are options. And the option that the political center and the majority seem to be taking. And this has kind of gone a bit further today in that a letter was written from our committee, even though we didn't have a committee meeting, but the leaders from our committee, and there's problems about this, they should have had the committee meeting first, have written to the commissioner asking for them to forget about ecological focus areas, which is about 4% of the land. And I'll give you the wording in their letter. To prevent the risk of protein shortage, the Commission should promptly take all necessary steps to allow the use of plant protection products. That's basically
pesticides and
etc. on ecological focus areas to facilitate growing protein crops. Now, my group that I'm a member of, the left, were a horrible shower, as I'm sure you've heard. Mm. And the Green group over here, who are, I have to say, I like the Greens in the European Parliament. I think they're a good group, unlike at home, many is the time, but I've good time for them.
Don't get me started.
neither of our groups supported the letter. And in particular, we didn't want that part included.
So, can I come in on that for a second? Because you know what reminds me of immediately, which is, because if you when I started talking to Leszek Vasilenko and Maria Mezentseva, it was on the basis that the Ukrainian, obviously Ukraine has been referred to as the breadbasket. It produces wheat and grain and at levels that not just going to hurt the EU, going to hurt Africa, where they provide feed, where they provide these things. And it reminded me immediately. And as I said, I spoke to both of the women about their work on the Green Deal for Europe. And that's what now, obviously, it's evolved into. I was talking to Maria and she was setting up drones for use in military thing. Like, this is, that's insane when you're having those conversations with someone. But nonetheless, I digress. The whole thing reminds me of the TRIPS waiver yet again, whereby we sat on our hands in the EU and said, we're not going to agree to the TRIPS waiver, and we're going to hoard all the vaccines, and you know, we'll go this way. I'm terrified when I read something like that, Luke. We're going to say, well, actually, here's a great opportunity to turn off the actual, ignore the climate crisis spiraling down the road at us, ignore sustainable agriculture, ignore food insecurity. Let's, devil be damned, let's just plow on. That's really scary in the context of the fog of war.
Well, if ever the phrase never miss a crisis as an opportunity. Like, you know, there are times I hear that and I'm a bit cynical about why people are saying it. But I'm quite literally buried in the center of this whole thing at the moment, because this is what I do. And if ever they were using a crisis to their benefit, this is the case. Because for a start, what they're talking about, they haven't even looked at, would, if you planted every one of those areas, would you come even close to supplying the protein that you will no longer have? What they don't mention as well is that when they talk about protein, they're not on about a shortage of protein to feed people. They're on about a shortage of protein to feed animals, so we can then subsequently feed them to people at a time when there's potentially going to be a shortage of food. And you've often heard, and you heard Leo Varadkar say it, and when Leo Varadkar says it, you double check it every time, no more than what he said about climate change. Leo Varadkar said, we are sustainable in food. We produce enough food.
To feed 50 million.
No. Simon Coveney said we produce enough food when he was Minister for Agriculture. He said we produce enough food to feed 50 million people.
When Simon says it, when Simon says it, for some reason, people will believe him. I don't. But when Leo said it, I was listening. I was wondering, where did he get that information from? Because it's something that I've been working on. There's information out there that, on one occasion in the last 10 years, Ireland imported, in food calorie terms, more calories than we exported, to the tune of enough calories to feed, wait for this, 2.5 million people. We imported so much foodstuff to feed to animals, then to subsequently export as less calories in animal protein, that we were 2.5 million people calories short. That's what we were. And then I hear, depends. They pick the figure out of their arse. Yes. It's 20 million one day we can feed. It's 40 million the next day. What do you eat? I don't know what you eat, but all I know is this is what I eat. I eat lots of spuds. We don't produce enough spuds. I eat lots of carrots. We don't produce enough carrots. We don't produce enough of our salads, no matter what Eamon Ryan suggested we do. We don't produce enough wheat. We don't produce our own sugar. But still, we're going to feed the world. And as a former assistant of mine said to me 10 years ago, when I knew nothing about this, I said, sure, aren't we sustainable? He goes, yeah, fine. He says, if you want to go around eating milk crumb, he said, yeah, we're sustainable, yeah. All right. But if you fancy eating something else, well, then it's different. But it gets worse. It gets worse. We keep hearing, and I keep hearing it at the Agri Committee, Europe is going to feed the world. The European Union is a net importer of calories. So when we talk about what are we going to deal with this crisis, and we're talking about a protein shortage, we are not talking about a protein shortage for people. We are talking about a protein shortage for an industry, and for an industry that wants to keep making money. And now a lot of people would say, well, what is your answer? What's the alternative? Well, this is where it gets really scary. Currently, the European Union is giving financial incentives to farmers in Ireland through a thing called the BEAM scheme to put the most sustainable beef farmers out of business. And what they have done is, there's a thing called a suckler farmer, where basically the calf stays with the cow and basically feeds off it, and it's reared with it, and it's done outside. It's done generally in an extensive way. So from the point of view of feeding the animal, you have virtually no input costs from the point of view of buying the protein. From the point of view of fertilizer, most of these people operate in an extensive system where they have clover growing with their grass, meaning you need very little nitrogen input. But what has happened in the last year and a half, actually the last 2 years, in the last 2 years, the European Union put 50 million and the Irish government put 50 million in place to incentivize those farmers to reduce their stocking rate and to reduce the number of cattle that they had and to make way for dairy beef. Mm. Dairy beef, which requires inputs from the Brazilian rainforest, from Ukraine, requires massive amount of nitrogen, requires a nitrate derogation because they dump so much shit on the land that they pollute every water course around them. And at the moment, we are still incentivizing people to go out of business who don't need fertilizer, don't need to import protein. And what is their solution? Our solution isn't to reverse gear and to protect those farmers. Our solution is to drive on and not only to do the bad thing, but to then plant all of the environmentally friendly areas so we can feed even more. Yeah,
so forget about the biodiversity crisis. Let's plow on and let's keep, and we'll hear. But there's one, I just wanted to find the quotes actually. So 2014, Simon Coveney said it was virtually impossible to feed the world and to protect the environment. That's what he said in 2014 when he was the Minister for Agriculture, that we have, you know, we want to, and they set the goal then that by 2020, Ireland will feed, have enough food to feed 36 million people. And yet, yeah, we're told we're food insecure currently.
Well, it's quite clear that it's actually the opposite is the case, that unless you have sustainable agriculture, you will have mass starvation around this planet. Because if we keep degrading the soils by putting insane amount of fertilizers on them, if we continue to pollute our water courses, we will have no agriculture. And at the moment, we are reacting to hopefully something that is relatively short term in comparison to climate change, because climate change is forever. And once we miss this point, we have missed this opportunity forever. So in order to deal with what is an horrendous crisis at the moment, horrible for people, but at the same time, something that is not going to go on forever, we are now looking at going after policies that will impact on us forever and will cause resource wars in the future because we are doing it. There's one big thing that we are doing in European agriculture that at the moment we could stop, that if they did want to make more room for proteins to feed animals, if they want to follow that folly, fine. And that is, we have millions of hectares in the European Union currently planted to grow grain for oil, so we can put it in cars, and supposedly then it's more environmentally friendly. We need to stop doing that. We also need to stop growing biomass as a primary crop, because it does not make sense, not unless you have fairies planting it who don't use any energy, and then floating fairies who dig it up again and process it. Unless you have that fantasy scenario, it's not sustainable. So if we're worried about a shortage of land, there is something we can do. We can stop planting these energy crops, which at the end of the day provide us with less energy than we actually put into them in the first place to create them.
But farmers are going to face, I mean, if this isn't short, Luke, farmers are going to face real problems come this winter, particularly in herd farmers, dairy and beef. They're going to face huge problems with feed this winter, absolutely huge problems. But I agree with you, it's a lack of biodiversity. I agree with you, we have far too much cattle in this. We are geared up for cattle. That's all we're really geared up for is cattle.
We're strip mined for milk powder, like Australia is strip mined for basically metals.
But is the solution that we should have more to, you know, that we should be able to feed the cattle that are on our own land? That's that should be a bottom line. We shouldn't be, we shouldn't have to import feed from anywhere
else. We should refer to, Martin, the phrase that they use here, and you know, it's a language in itself. You know yourself, any area you go near, there's a language around it. And the language around this is land-based agriculture. You produce what your land can produce, as opposed to I will put a couple of thousand animals in a shed, like they do now in Ireland, and they do it even more so in the Netherlands, and we import it from all over the world, and you feed them that way. We have to move away from that system. And I don't know why politicians are afraid to say this. We need to cut herd numbers. The question is, which ones do we need to cut? Do we cut the suckler farmer, which we're currently doing, which means you don't need inputs, meaning
I think cut is a very loaded word, Luke. Nothing needs to be cut. You just got to stop breeding them.
We need to stop producing that much. But it is important which ones you go for. Like, because you know, you can say, "Oh well, dairy is the problem." Yeah, intensive dairy is the problem. But your man who sells Clun Conra cheese out the road from me, who has a special breed of cattle that don't compact the land, that don't require high protein feed, that are specifically suited to land, and the cheese he produces, well, you're not going to get more sustainable. And he's got gang grazing so that the carbon is put back into the soil. That's good. Intensive dairy is bad. And then you have intensive beef and you have extensive beef. So it's a question of, it's not a question of, oh, get rid of all dairy and get rid of all beef. It's a question of which you do and which is more sustainable. And it's quite clear which is more sustainable. And the sad thing at the moment is we are incentivizing them to go out of business, and we've got to stop that. I have made a proposal to the Agriculture Committee, and I will be making it again next week. And that is, you've heard me talk about it in the past, this idea of convergence, that every farmer gets the same amount for their bit of land. We've also got another thing, which in the context of how we treat our Eastern European neighbours in the European Union is so important, because you've also got external convergence, where certain countries get less than others. For example, in the Baltic countries, who we think we're going to protect by giving them more weapons. At the same time, we pay them half the amount on average per hectare than we do in the rest of Europe. So I have made a proposal that we have external convergence, which will mean that all of the Eastern European states will get the same average per hectare as everyone else, because that really tells those people you are an equal. You are not here so we can get cheap labor out here making IKEA stuff in Romania, or we can get cheap fruit from you in Poland, while at the same time given the neighboring country in Germany, in some cases payments that are three times as high. So what I, yet again, if it's all about never using a crisis as an opportunity, let's use it as an opportunity to do something good. And if we're all on about sending messages from the European Union to Vladimir Putin, what better message could you send to him than to say, you know what, from now on, if you're in Latvia or if you're in France or if you're in Ireland, we will pay you the same amount and we will treat you equally. And to me, that's the best way to say, yeah, it's going to be a European Union of equals, not a European Union of you're handy for cheap labor and keep you like that.
Yeah, no, I think I said that to you last night, Martin, on the pod, that my big fear is Ukrainian people were going to arrive and Frank McDonough was going to meet them from Supermax and say to them, here's a low.
And to be honest, Tony, there is certainly an element of that going on in business at the moment. They wanted cheap labor brought in and they are kind of salivating at the idea that they can use Ukrainian as cheap labor. And we have to be very careful about this. These people are not cheap labor.
No,
you know, that's not what they're here for.
And they've just lost their homes.
Yeah, yeah. And to be further exploited by Irish businesses. And we've seen today how exploitative Irish business is when we see petrol prices going up in anticipation of the court. I mean, we've seen how I just can't get over business figures in Ireland. I can't get over the greasy till attitude that has prevailed for over 100 years. I can't
it's a big issue for the people who are coming over, going to be coming over to Ireland, that we don't do that, because you know it's always seems to be the instinct. And what really gets me on that one was, you know, I was always told when I was growing up that was the instinct of the Brits to pour paddy. And by God, did we forget it and ape it awful quickly.
And given a little hat tip, I believe Priti Patel rang Helen McEntee and expressed her concerns about the common travel area because of the refugees that her Ukrainian refugees were coming in. And I'm pretty sure, I don't know the phraseology, but I believe Helen McEntee stood up and said, you know, more or less said, yeah, you'd like to steal my lunch, but have you met my friends, collective support in the EU? Go away. And the Brits will have to suck it up, because what they've done is actually quite disgraceful, like anonymous people saying they're concerned about the Irish common travel area. Yeah. So that is gross. Like I don't think
Priti Patel kicks down. I understand she carries a cordless angle grinder with her at all time to cut the steps below as she climbs the ladder. So no one can even grab onto it, you know?
But Luke, last thing. What's the, just in terms of, you know, the next few months of this, are the EU, do you think, we're looking at inflation continuing to rise, we're looking at supports that are going to be needed, all of the talk of, you know, we're going to see an end of, you know, the kind of the era of quantitative easing is over, the era of cheap credit is over. None of that can go away now, because we need to, all of these supports will have to be paid for somehow. All of these humanitarian aid will actually have to be done, and it can't be paid for by people at the bottom who are already suffering in economies in Ireland and elsewhere in the EU. Is the EU, do you feel the EU Parliament is ready to take huge steps to make sure we've come out of a global financial crisis into the plague and now into a war?
I think from the prevailing wind and the instinct in the European Parliament will be to make the same mistake again. And what I mean by the same mistake again is to be even tougher when it comes to debt write-down than the IMF. And when the ECB and the banking arm of the European Union is decent when it comes to debt write-down, and that's not that long ago, it's hard to see it changing very much. And for me, like, people go on about extremism. If they're worried about extremism in the European Parliament, if they don't do this right within a very, very short time, it will lead to extremism. The same way as it led to extremism in Germany after the First World War, the same way as everywhere it leads to extremism. And what I would say, the best way to keep people away from extremism is to give them full bellies and to have them happy and to have them satisfied. But if you create a situation where it feels like your neighbour has something and that means you don't, you're going to create a very nasty situation. So we have an opportunity here to create a whole new society and a whole new situation with many people coming and say, you know what, not only will we bring these people in, we'll bring even more people in, because we have a half-empty island and we have great potential to have a brilliant country. Or we'll go down the road of hate, and we'll go down the road of not doing it right, and we'll go down the road of anything but debt restructuring or anything but debt write-off. Well, then we're in trouble. We know the right path to take, but it's hard to have confidence that they'll do the right thing. The left have an amendment in on one of the resolutions this week on the financial situation, looking for the possibility for debt write down and looking for a similar situation that there was with COVID, where they wouldn't be strict on as strict on deficits, etc. We have to do that to the nth degree, because anyone who thinks we'll save money by doing it in more in the long run.
I don't hold out much hope after listening to Pascal Donoghue on the news today, Luke.
Neither do I.
And I don't. And when you think how influential he is with ministers of finance across Europe, he's talking the language of austerity again. He's like Silas Marner at this stage. He's just collecting money for the sake of collecting money. He has left money on the table for COVID, as Tony will tell you. He's left billions on the table. We did best performing economy through the pandemic, and he's still coming out and saying, we can't afford to spend. We can't afford to support people. We bloody well can. He's the most dangerous man in Ireland, and he needs to be got rid of. He just needs to go.
Yeah, I often wonder how influential he is. I would say the reason why he gets listened to is because he's saying what they want him to say anyway. So it's kind of, it's handy. Yeah, it almost seems like it's influential, but they got the perfect character. He was picked for this reason, I think, you know.
Oh, yeah, I agree completely. But, you know, when you listen to him, and I mean, there are rumors, Tony will tell you, there are rumors that he's going to big numbers with when the next election and Fine Gael don't get elected, that he's out of there, going to a big job, you know, banker's job in the EU. But, you know, he's totally the wrong person. He's totally, utterly the wrong person.
Martin, I don't know why to personalize it with Pascal Donoghue. The man is just a austerity neocon who his economics are based in, you know, neoliberal Thatcherite stuff that has been rebranded and given some new. Maybe he's listened to the odd David McWilliams podcast and thinks that makes him cool or something. But like, honestly, don't give him any more credit than he deserves. Giving him far too much credit.
Just on the personalization thing, it's something I don't like that politicians say, oh, don't personalize it. The decisions they make are very personal to people. Very, very personal.
I get that.
I don't agree with that. Let's not personalize.
I didn't say that to you. I actually said that this is the second podcast in a row where you've just called him the most dangerous man.
And he's going to be the most dangerous man in Europe if he gets a big job in there.
I wouldn't be afraid looking over my shoulder for Pascal Donoghue any day. I can tell you that,
Tony,
much.
Tony, it's the structural damage, structural violence.
He is personally making these decisions. So
yeah, absolutely.
We can separate the person from a person making the decision.
I think he's stuck. I think he has no. He hasn't woken up to how the world changed over the last decade and the opportunities, as you say, Luke. These are opportunities to do things better. And he has decided, actually, the narrative that they still say in the Department of Finance is that austerity worked, which is bullshit. Austerity did not work. And the idea that we cannot, like, the idea that you can't have debt forgiveness and then you have this nonsense of moral hazard. Ukraine needs debt forgiveness tomorrow, by the way. Ukraine was already needed it. It didn't need it without a war happening. It needs it bloody quickly now. And that would send a proper message beyond any resolution. But I'd just be very worried that I think I don't know how much better some of the alternatives are, Martin, and that's the reality. You may think that it's going to change overnight when you change the personalities. I don't agree with you. I think too many of them are cut from the same cloth, and it'll be business as usual. Unfortunately, in some cases, but go on. Do you want to come back at me? Go on.
Well, I sort of with Luke. I'm a big believer in debt forgiveness. And if you look historically back over thousands of years, debt forgiveness was something that made everything gel together and work. You know, when a new emperor came into power, all debt was forgiven. And I don't mean all debt. I mean all personal debt, labor debt, as we call it, was forgiven. Business debt existed. But we've stopped, and we only really stopped doing that as a planet in the 1900s. Before that, there was always debt forgiveness. And the idea that we can't have debt forgiveness, it's a wipe clean. It's a start over. It is like fertilizing land to do debt forgiveness. That's exactly what it's like. It helps things to grow.
There isn't a fundamental issue with debt forgiveness, though, in Ireland. There's a fundamental issue with who gets debt forgiveness.
Yes, they give it to the opposite.
If you were in part of the old independent news and media, debt forgiveness for you is all right. Well, for a start, no one will hear about it because it won't be reported. And debt forgiveness for your neighbour who can pay their mortgage and will get thrown out on their ear isn't okay, because there's a thing called moral hazard.
That's right.
Which you're not allowed to talk about moral hazard of giving money hand over fist to a newspaper group and then letting them off on the debt. Like, I would imagine there's more danger of a moral hazard in a forgiving debt to a media group than there is to a parent of a family. And the same newspapers then drum up this idea that, well, you know, somehow if my neighbour is forgiven debt, that makes me worse off. No, it doesn't. It actually makes you better off, because now you're living beside someone who can get on with their life and contribute to society. But that's reported as dangerous and we can't do it. But the issue of debt forgiveness, sure, that's built into business thinking. But when it comes to ordinary people, it's a bloody dangerous thing to do.
Exactly. The market has no memory. It just prices it in, it moves on. And that's what it does. And it already does it. But Luke, we'll leave it there. I will want to come back to you on the whole food thing, because it's terrifying that they're talking about using this as this crisis as an opportunity to rip up. And as I said, that there was the quote from 2013 from Simon Coveney saying, we can't feed everyone and do climate action, more or less is what he said. And that's the mentality that you've more or less said was in that letter to a degree, you know, let's play on. And let's do it. And rather than actually let's adjust the way we do things, let's just double down on the things that weren't working already. And I think that's a scary message to finish this podcast on. Thanks for talking.
There's one other interesting thing as well, Tony, which I find funny. I find it sadly ironic. Only 6 weeks ago at the Agri Committee, I said, okay, we have dealt with COVID up until now, and you're saying, yeah, if the sustainability of our food systems held together. I made the point, what happens if we get a worse crisis and things get worse and we have to feed ourselves within our borders and we can't move food across borders? I was told to a man and a woman in that committee, no, our systems are perfect. We're now having emergency meetings about how we can make our food system sustainable. What changed in the last 6 weeks? Nothing, other than they've stopped lying to themselves. Nothing.
Have you thrown a few cabbages down yourself, Luke? Are you going to throw a few
cabbages? No, I plant a more productive crop on my balcony in Brussels.
Listen, folks, if you're in time, I'm heading out to South Dublin now to knock over south-facing window boxes that are growing salads, because he got right up my nose today.
Listen, Luke, thank you very much for coming on and having this chat with us. And it's lovely to see, and we met Isabel, your daughter, and it's lovely to see her doing so well, and particularly on International Women's Day yesterday. She was brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah, she's
brilliant.
She said, I wouldn't, you worry about your children, but I wouldn't worry about that one.
Luke, thanks for having this chat with us. Lovely to talk to you again.
Talk to you. Bye-bye.
Back soon, folks. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.